Welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today. It is Thursday, March 28, 2024. I'm your reader, Kathleen. From the front page of the Gazette today, the headline reads, Hills Elementary to Close, Iowa City School Board Decides. This story by Grace King. Hills Elementary School is closing its doors at the end of the school year in an effort to preserve educational programs and staff in the Iowa City Community School District as Iowa schools continue to face budget shortfalls. The Iowa City School Board unanimously approved the decision Tuesday, saying that while they don't want to close the school, it's in the best interest of all students as they deal with the reality of needing to slash the budget. There are no other cuts to be made unless we are willing to start touching student programming. Things like music, foreign language, or librarians, and extracurricular activities, school board member Lisa Williams said. I consider those programs to be essential to our students' experiences, and I will continue to pursue cuts that save us operational dollars. The decision saves the district about $1.66 million, getting the district closer to the $7.5 million in expenses needed to be trimmed from the district over the next 2 years. The Iowa City school leaders have been slashing the district's budget for the last 18 months, Williams said. Over the last 3 years, $24.7 million has been reduced from the district's spending plan, she said. Last year, we cut millions from our budget by eliminating 11 administrator positions, offering early retirement plans to teachers, many who were not ready to stop teaching, but they left because it was in the best interest of the district. We delayed the purchase of much-needed curriculum, Williams said. The budget cuts are a result of decades of chronic and persistent underfunding by the state, Williams said. It is a direct result of the governor and legislature's decision to take your tax dollars and divert them away from public schools. About 100 community members turned up at the meeting, and 20 people gave emotional pleas to keep the school open in the town about 6 miles south of Iowa City. I hope you all start advocating for public education the way you have advocated to keep your school open, because it's impressive, Williams said to the crowd. If you want to do something to help our schools, vote in November for those candidates who really want to support public schools, school board member Molly Abraham said. The more than 100 students currently enrolled at Hills Elementary could be sent to Alexander and Weber Elementary Schools, Superintendent Matt Degner said during a board meeting last month. Its teachers and staff will have the option to being reassigned to another school in the district, and students still would have access to the services they get now at Hills, including preschool. Some residents who spoke during public comment said they were frustrated that school leaders did not go to the city of Hills to meet with residents and Hills Elementary families. Williams and other board members said over the last few weeks they had read every email, every news story, and followed discussions on social media in regard to the possible closure of Hills Elementary School. Nearly every email and letter spoke about how the school was the heart of the community, Williams said. I understand this is a significant decision with serious ramifications for the Hills community, Williams said. I do not believe the closure of Hills will have an adverse impact on students. The educational experience these students will have at their new school will be the same high-caliber educational experience we currently have at Hills. Abraham said every email and letter to the editor about Hills Elementary gave her an empathy for the anger, sorrow, distrust, fear, and angst people feel about the decision to close the school. Our North Star has been to not cut staff and not cut programs. I fully believe students from Hills will be embraced by whatever school they choose to attend, Abraham said. Williams said she believes the city of Hills will be worse off without the elementary school. I hear you, and your concerns are valid, and I agree with them, but I cannot let those concerns influence my decision. She referenced Iowa Code, saying the law prohibits her from using school funds to save a rural community. Every dollar we spend must be for improving student outcomes, Williams said. School Board President Ruthena Malone said she and the board take full responsibility and accept the blame for the decision to close Hills Elementary. "I am truly sorry to the students, families, and community members for the tough decisions we must face that have ramifications for everyone in the Iowa City Community School District. With every single budget reduction we did last year, that we will do this year, and that we will do next year," she said. Mate Flores and Marcella Hurtado, residents of mobile home parks in the Hills Elementary attendance boundary, said the school is a place where their children are treated with respect and dignity. "It is a place that has helped them to excel and feel proud of their roots and culture," said Flores, translating for Marcella, who spoke in Spanish. Hills Elementary is one of the most diverse schools in the Iowa City Community School District. About 36% of students at Hills are Hispanic or Latino, and more than 13% are Black, according to U.S. News and World Report. About 70% of students at Hills are economically disadvantaged. Mary Kelly said her granddaughter, a first grader at Hills Elementary, is learning Spanish and helping her classmates learn English. "Those children are each other's family," Kelly said. "They take care of each other. They support each other. They know each other. Closing that building, I think, is going to devastate the community." Hills City Council member Emily Hudacek, who herself attended Hills Elementary as a child, said the large turnout of the community members should give the school board pause in shutting down the school. "It's time to show the community, but more importantly the students, that they matter and that their voices have been heard," Hudacek said. Michael Tilley, who has four kids in Iowa City schools, was the sole speaker in favor of closing Hills Elementary. "We are going to lose some of the great things about our district to keep Hills open. Make the hard call tonight," Tilley said. Hills Elementary is the smallest elementary school in the district and has the highest cost per student of schools in the district. Most of the students at Hills Elementary are bused to the school from outside the small community of about 1,000 residents. Only about 45 students who attend Hills live in the town, and other students are bused to the school from areas north of Hills, the southern portion of Iowa City, and unincorporated parts of Johnson County. District officials did explore other options for Hills, including the feasibility of transferring other students into Hills, according to board documents. They found this doesn't make fiscal sense because while it would decrease the cost per pupil at Hills, it would increase transportation costs and per pupil spending at the other schools. Enrollment at Iowa City Elementary Schools next year is projected to be 70% of the district's capacity. This leaves about 3,000 open spots for elementary students. A large portion of the projected decline in elementary enrollment can be attributed to the plan to move sixth graders from the district's elementary schools to its middle schools this fall, a change approved by the school board in February 2022. Like many school districts in Iowa, Iowa City Schools has faced declining enrollment since the pandemic began in spring 2020. During the 2019-2020 school year, the district had an enrollment of about 14,500 students. This dropped to 14,200 during the 2020-21 school year and rebounded to 14,440 students this year. The Iowa City School District isn't alone in the need to make budget cuts. Des Moines Public Schools announced a $14 million budget reduction for the 2024-25 school year. Last week, the Lenmar Community School District reduced 50 staff, including 19 teachers, as part of the $2.5 million in budget cuts. More than 100 school districts across Iowa this year are going to have to increase their property taxes to cover the shortfall in their budgets due to underfunding by the state, Williams said. Also on the front page today, the first of Cedar Rapids' quiet zones could be a year away. This story by Marissa Payne. In the city of Cedar Rapids' long quest to establish quiet zones to reduce the number of train horns sounding downtown and the new Bohemia District, city staff anticipate the first phase of work will be complete within the next year or so. but some members of the Cedar Rapids City Council this week expressed frustration with delays brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic and material shortages, and sought assurance the railroad companies involved would make the improvements needed to establish the designated quiet zones. The council Tuesday approved plans for an estimated $510,000 segment of quiet zone improvements on 4th Street Southeast from 1st Avenue East to 5th Avenue Southeast. As part of Phase A, this project will reconstruct roadway and railroad crossing approaches, as well as storm sewer, sidewalks, and pedestrian ramps. New signage and pavement markings also will be installed. This will be done in coordination with the Union Pacific Railroad's new railroad crossing gates and flashers at these crossings. City engineer Ken DeCasey said Union Pacific has wrapped up installing signals and gates at 1st Avenue East, so the city will finish work around the crossing with the accessible sidewalk and pedestrian improvements, such as safety rails. As this 4th Street Southeast project is in the works, DeCasey said city staff are asking Canadian National Railway to provide an engineering agreement at Stickle Drive Northeast that would allow the company to design the project and get on a construction schedule for signal and crossing improvements, he said. Then the city can complete road and sidewalk improvement. That also is within Phase A, just north of downtown, and would complete the phase in 2024 or 2025. Then we can move on to Federal Railroad Administration to actually get the quiet zone implemented and up and running, DeCasey said. City staff also are working with Union Pacific to finalize an engineering agreement and start design on Phase B. Construction could start in 2025. In addition to Union Pacific and Canadian National, the Cedar Rapids and Iowa City Railway Company, known as Crandic, is the third company the city is working with to implement the zones. To establish a quiet zone, safety upgrades to rail crossings need to be completed so that they are in compliance with federal guidelines. These safety upgrades include at least 2 gates and flashers, but also may include 4 gate systems, the addition of medians, closure of driveways near the railroad tracks, and additional safety devices, especially for pedestrians. The city is responsible for construction related to the roadway and sidewalk, but the railroad companies handle work associated with the rail lines, including gate arms, flashers, and bells. Because the railroads install these items, council member Scott Olson said one of the issues is that the city can't push that along or use different contractors. He said work on the 1st Avenue E quiet zone improvements has been delayed for over 2 years because the railroad companies are struggling to secure necessary materials or equipment. We've spent lots of money, but yet we don't get the quiet zone until A Avenue is done, Olson said. Are they going to push that out where we wait 2 or 3 years, spend the money, but still don't have the quiet zone? DeCasey said discussions have been ongoing with railroads to get work done, and city staff are optimistic that Phase A will be in place this year. We are pushing it. Our discussions seem pretty optimistic. They seem to think they can get moving on that, DeCasey said of Canadian National, but we have to get this agreement. Mayor Tiffany O'Donnell said she and City Manager Jeff Pomerantz have had productive conversations with some new leadership at Canadian National. Ashley Vanorney, in her 7th year serving on City Council, said the council anticipated the project would take 2 or 3 years when it started in 2017. That was the year voters first elected her. Knowing that there are several different agencies, certainly we're in our 175th year of Cedar Rapids because we were founded and brought together by rail, but I also know that they move on their own timeline, so I want to temper expectations a little bit, Vanorney said. If there continues to be a standstill, Vanorney asked that staff let council know, because we've been hearing this is going to happen this year for several years now. Turning now to some Iowa Today news, this story from Waterloo Cedar Falls. John Deere will lay off more than 300 Waterloo workers in April. More than 300 employees of John Deere's Waterloo operations will lose their jobs in late April, the company confirmed on Tuesday. A John Deere spokesperson said 317 production workers will be laid off indefinitely April 29. Employees reportedly learned of the layoffs in meetings with factory leaders Tuesday. John Deere informed members of the workforce at its Waterloo operations in Waterloo, Iowa, on Tuesday, March 26, that 317 production employees will be placed on indefinite layoff effective April 29. Employees were told of the layoffs by factory leadership in meetings today, a Deere statement said. Each John Deere factory balances the size of its production workforce with the needs of the individual factory to optimize the workforce at each facility. John Deere Waterloo operations currently have about 5,500 total employees, with about 3,600 of them working in production and maintenance jobs. Numbers posted to the Iowa Workforce Development, WARN, or Worker Adjustment and Retraining Act, website indicated 308 workers will be idled effective April 26. The discrepancy couldn't be immediately resolved on Tuesday. The announcement comes 2 weeks after the company announced it will lay off 150 workers at its Ankeny location. According to recent Deere earnings reports, the company made $10.1 billion in fiscal 2023 and is projecting earnings of $7.5 billion to $7.75 billion for fiscal 2024. In February, the company reported net income of $1.751 billion for the first quarter of 2024, which ended January 28, or $6.23 per share. That was down from the same time period last year when the company reported a net income of $1.959 billion, or $6.55 per share. The company announced February 28 that the largest, most powerful tractor it has ever made is expected to roll off the assembly lines in Waterloo in mid-2024. The new 9RX tractor is a flexible, swivel-joint, articulated tractor with four huge treads or tracks. The tractor can be fitted with 830, 770, or 710 horsepower engines. This story by Aaron Jordan is titled, Anamosa Releases Sewage into the Wapsie. An equipment failure Wednesday morning caused Anamosa to accidentally release 50,000 gallons of untreated sewage into the Wapsipinicon River, officials said. The Iowa Department of Natural Resources is investigating the discharge discovered about 8:15 a.m. An equipment failure at the city's wastewater plant lift station caused the sewage to flow into a storm drain leading to the river, the Iowa DNR reported. City officials said the bypass has been corrected and cleanup has begun. Downstream recreational users, such as anglers, should stay out of the river at this time, the Iowa DNR warned on Wednesday. No dead fish have been observed so far. The agency will follow up with the city for further assessment. Anamosa, a city of about 5,300 in Jones County, is in the Iowa DNR's Region 6, based in Manchester. To report a release after hours, please call the Iowa DNR's Emergency Spill Line. That number is 515-725-8694. Quick reporting can help staff identify the cause of an incident. The Iowa DNR website has more information about spill reporting requirements. Also in Iowa Today News, this story by Grace King, $5.5 million cut from Iowa City School's budget next year. Delaying curriculum purchases, adjusting a model used to control class size, and reducing staff through attrition are just a few ways the Iowa City Community School District is reducing next year's budget by $5.5 million. The Iowa City School Board approved millions in budget cuts Tuesday, including closing an elementary school all recommendations to achieve the district's general fund reduction. School leaders say the cuts are necessary to make ends meet after decades of the state underfunding public schools, declining enrollment, and the implementation of private school tuition assistance this year. About 60 Iowa City Public School students used new education savings accounts created by the Iowa legislature last year to attend private school this year. School Board President Ruthena Malone said this is the third round of major budget cuts she has voted on since beginning her tenure on board 2017. She prays it will be her last, she said. Times are going to be tough, Malone said. To the admin, I'm sorry you will be asked to do more with little extra. To the teachers, you are the backbone of our team here. We ask you to please stand with us, knowing that we are trying to support you. I know it's hard to have 32 kids in an art room, but we're trying to protect your positions. Like many school districts in Iowa, Iowa City Schools has faced declining enrollment since the pandemic began in spring 2020. During the 2019-2020 school year, the district had an enrollment of about 14,500. This dropped to 14,200 students during the 2021-22 school year and rebounded to 14,440 this year. J.P. Clausen, school board vice president, said the Iowa City School District was protected from declining enrollment for a long time, growing by 100 to 300 students a year. Under the state's per-pupil funding formula, growing enrollment creates more revenue for school districts. But the school district budget is really tight, with 86% of every dollar spent on staff salaries and benefits. Another large expense is the fixed cost of utilities, Clausen said. The story of Iowa is that we lose students, Clausen said. Right now in Iowa City, the growth is gone. This is a direct result of the governor and legislature's decision to take your tax dollars and divert them away from public schools, board member Lisa Williams said before voting in favor of closing Hills Elementary on Tuesday, a cost savings of $1.66 million for the school district. Nobody wants to fire teachers, increase class sizes, reduce busing, or eliminate programming, but these are our only options if the legislature continues to divert are much-needed resources to private schools, Williams said. This is not a partisan issue. This is an Iowan issue. It's only going to get worse if we do not hold Des Moines accountable. Under the state's Education Savings Account Program, K-12 students can apply for taxpayer-funded scholarships equal to the state's per-pupil public education funding, which in the current school year is $7,598. Public school districts receive about $1,200 in state funding for each student in their district who receives a private school scholarship. That money is intended to help offset loss of state funding from a student leaving the district. School board members also spoke adamantly about the importance of maintaining the district's weighted resource allocation model, which is used to control class sizes based on rates of students who face barriers in their education. The district is making adjustments to the model under the budget cuts, reducing 7 full-time educators through attrition, a cost savings of $630,000. But the budget cuts allow for the integrity of the model to be kept, school board members said. School board members said they felt like making decisions, such as closing Hills Elementary, helps the district preserve aspects of teaching and learning, like the weighted resource allocation model that is critical to student success. The model moves test scores in the right direction, a hard thing to achieve, Clausen said. The model provides better class sizes for our most marginalized students, school board member Mitch Lingo said. Other cost-saving measures approved by the board on Tuesday include reducing 9 full-time educators through early retirement, a $500,000 savings, reduction through attrition of 5 full-time staff leaving the district for other opportunities, a $450,000 savings, reducing a central staff administrator position will be a $200,000 cost savings, an annual and optional professional learning day for teachers scheduled for August was canceled, an additional $407,000 in savings. Modifying the district's teacher leadership program saves $500,000, and delaying curriculum purchases to save $1 million. Reducing the number of building substitute teachers for a $270,000 cost savings, and phasing out insurance for building substitutes for an additional $315,000 in savings, and lastly, increasing employee insurance contributions, a $770,000 savings. Turning now to the Insight page, Bridge Collapse Tests American Resolve. This is a reprint from Wednesday's Washington Post. The nation awoke Tuesday to images of a ghastly tragedy. Baltimore's iconic Francis Scott Key Bridge had collapsed after a giant cargo ship lost power and control and slammed into one of the bridge's key support columns. Several vehicles and 8 construction workers were on the bridge, and rescue crews raced to save them from the cold water of early spring. At a time when the nation seems ever more divided and its political institutions are mired in disagreement, this tragedy can't get caught up in partisan sniping. It's a time to rebuild and to tap what still is the United States' strength, its deep optimism. This response started immediately after the bridge spanning the Patapsco River fell. Rescuers managed to save at least 2 of the construction workers and worked to find the others. The action of bridge staff likely saved lives when they quickly attempted to halt traffic and clear the bridge, a crucial decision made about 90 seconds before the bridge collapsed. The cargo ship's steering system apparently failed. Many in the D.C. area know the Key Bridge well. More than 30,000 vehicles cross it on a typical day on the way to work or vacations on the Maryland shore. The river under the bridge is also a prime waterway for commerce and cruises. The next steps are clear. First is saving lives and recovering victims. Crews will then need to remove the bridge debris from the waterway. That will take time and special equipment. The focus will then turn to rebuilding the roughly mile-long section of the bridge that was destroyed, perhaps even improving on the previous structure for safety. Congressional lawmakers should move swiftly to allocate the money as Congress has in similar incidents. This is a moment for national unity, to ask how to help the families waiting to hear what happened to their loved ones and the first responders braving frigid waters, and to be ready to help rebuild. Almost a year ago, a bridge on Interstate 95 collapsed outside Philadelphia after a truck carrying gasoline lost control and caught fire. Politicians, union leaders, and engineers came together and reopened part of that highway in an incredible 12 days. Americans found a way to make it happen. We don't expect the Francis Scott Key Bridge to be rebuilt in 2 weeks, but the spirit of Philadelphia needs to move south to Baltimore. The country can show that it is not too divided to step up. And that is a reprint from the Washington Post. 24-Hour Dorman today is titled, Lab Meat Frightens Lawmakers. Iowa lawmakers have nightmares about lab-grown meat rising from its test tube and strangling the state's livestock industry. So, of course, they have a bill, Senate File 2391, designed to drive a stake through cultivated protein food products. The stake is a big old porterhouse, if you're wondering. What's a cultivated food product? Quote, a food product having one or more sensory attributes that would resemble the type of tissue originating from an agricultural food animal, but that, in lieu of being derived from meat processing, is derived from manufacturing cells in which one or more stem cells are initially isolated from an agricultural food animal, are grown in vitro, and may be manipulated. A misbranded food product labeled with an identifying meat term such as burger, bratwurst, etc., but is meatless, can't be sold unless it's also clearly labeled with words such as fake, plant-based, and vegan, end quotes. Community colleges, state universities, and K-12 public schools would be barred from purchasing misbranded meat products and cultivated protein food products. And if the federal government ever approves cultivated protein food products for purchase by recipients of food assistance, Iowa will be required to request a waiver to prohibit lab meat purchases. It passed the Senate without opposition and is now awaiting passage in the House. It's bipartisan. A House amendment would add eggs and dairy products to the bill. Far be it from me to oppose any labeling providing more information to consumers, but this is a useless bill for a couple of reasons. First, companies selling meatless products aren't trying to trick carnivores into buying plant-based brats or burgers. I have proof in my freezer thanks to my daughter, who quit eating red meat and chicken. These products are labeled to make sure people who want meatless products are not getting any meat. Burger patties made from plants, reads the Impossible Burger label. Second, even if you have a strong hankering for lab-grown meat, there's nowhere you can buy it. Last year, the USDA approved lab chicken for sale in two high-end restaurants in California, but those eateries dropped it, and it's no longer available in the U.S., according to the online magazine Wired. And if, eventually, lab meat turns out to be safe and affordable, why stop institutions and low-income people from buying it? What's the real motivation for this bill? Quote, this is a preventative measure against an activist federal government who wants to see our children eat from a petri dish, end quote, said Senator Don Driscoll, a Republican from Williamsburg. Ah, red state politics. The feds are going to force feed our kids lab meat. Do your research. It's all part of a plot to make us buy electric vehicles. Again, I'm all for labeling, so let's add labels to agricultural food animals, detailing environmental harm done by confined animal feeding operations. Let's add a warning that the meat you're about to consume might have been handled by immigrant child labor. How about, in the event of a pandemic, we will do nothing to protect meatpacking workers? The more consumers know, the better, right? And that is 24-Hour Doorman. One community letter today is titled, Thanks, Caitlin, we needed you. Almost everything that can be said about Caitlin Clark has been said. A transcendent player, a generational player, gracious and generous. Someone who has elevated not just women's basketball, but the game of basketball to a higher public awareness. It's all true, but I think there is much more about this player and her team that explains the massive public reaction to their success. We needed Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeyes. The pandemic and the societal unrest that accompanied it has changed us all. We have worked ourselves into a society with a paper-thin veneer, at risk of offending someone of something every time we open our mouths. It's not like Caitlin Clark is a new arrival on the scene. She was a great player in high school and has obviously been on a meteoric rise to world fame ever since. Nor is it something new about Lisa Bluter. She built a great program at Drake and has just continued to do great things at Iowa. No, what happened is the perfect convergence of time and events. Clark and the Hawkeye women arrived on the scene at just the right time and have given us a big dose of a few things we all need. Grit, determination, confidence, hope, class, grace, teamwork, commitments, and, most importantly, joy. I have heard nothing political or racial in any of the conversations about this amazing young woman. What a relief and what a legacy. Thank you, Caitlin. And that's signed by Richard Phillips from Des Moines. You're listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today, Thursday, March 28, on IRIS. And now we turn to today's obituary page, beginning with the short notices. First, in Cedar Rapids, Ronald Knight, age 82, died Wednesday, March 27, Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home and Cremation Service. In Maquoketa, Neil Keeney, 70, died Saturday, March 23. Carson Celebration of Life Center. In Tama, Johannes, known as Joe Wanity Sr., 77, died Wednesday, March 27. Cruz Phillips Funeral Home. Turning now to the regular notices. First, from Baldwin, Rodney L. Cozart, age 70, of Baldwin and formerly of Olin, passed away Monday, March 25th at home. A visitation will be held from 9 to 11 a.m. on Friday, March 29, at the Dawson Funeral Services in Olin. His funeral service will be at 11 a.m. on Friday, March 29, at Dawson Funeral Services. Burial will be at Olin Cemetery. To view his full obituary, visit DawsonFuneral.com. In Urbana, Leo M. Roseberry, age 93, passed away Tuesday, March 26th at Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids following a brief illness. Mass of Christian burial will be held at 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, April 2nd at St. Mary's Catholic Church in Urbana with Father Jim Brokerman officiating. Visitation will be from 4 until 7 p.m. Monday, April 1st, also at the church. Online condolences can be left at phillipsfuneralhome.com. In Cedar Rapids, J. David Carey, age 71, died Monday, March 25th in Mercy Medical Center after a brief illness. A visitation will be held Wednesday, April 3, from 4 to 7 p.m. at Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home. A celebration of life service will be planned at a later date. Memorials may be directed to the family, and a full obituary is available at cedarmemorial.com. From Cedar Rapids, Wayne A. Murdoch, 91, passed away peacefully in his home surrounded by family, Sunday, March 24. He leaves behind a legacy of a beloved family man, a Navy veteran, and a pillar of his community in which he loved so much. Born on April 20, 1932, to Donald D. Sr. and Hazel Putnam Murdoch, his journey was one defined by service, devotion, and enjoyment. After graduating from Roosevelt High School in 1950, he enlisted in the Navy and served in the Korean War. From Toddville, John Ray Glazier passed away March 19 after a hard-fought battle with Alzheimer's disease. Born in Estherville, Iowa, John spent much of his childhood near Grettinger, where his grandparents owned a local cafe. Some of his fondest memories were in the cafe and surrounding small communities. Those small-town roots helped forge his strong work ethic and desire to lend a hand whenever he could. After high school, John spent 2 years in junior college before joining the Air Force, where he dedicated 8 years of service. From Marion, Kenneth R. Burns, Sr., age 87, passed away Tuesday morning, March 26th, at the Hiawatha Care Center in Hiawatha. A celebration of life will be at 11 a.m. Friday, March 29, at the Jameson Schmitz Funeral Home in Arlington. Visitation is 10 to 11 a.m. Friday at the funeral home. Interment at Taylorsville Cemetery, Arlington, with military honors. Memorials may be directed to the family, and an online obituary is available at jamesonschmitzfuneralhome.com. Kenneth was born April 22, 1936, in Volga, Iowa, the son of Winifred and Lyle Burns. Kenneth attended Volga High School and joined the military at age 17, serving in the Marines from 1953 to 1959. Turning now to the sports page, girls golf is on the front page. Lynn Mars Rupp focused on strength to gain length. This story by KJ Pilcher. Lynn Mars Morgan Rupp followed a specific routine this winter. Her morning started at 5:45. She made her way to the basement and a makeshift home gym. Weight training lasted about 90 minutes before she'd get breakfast and leave for class that started at 9. Rupp focused on becoming stronger and adding more driving distance to her golf game. Add the time spent working on swing speed and mechanics, and the results came quickly. "I feel like all those things came together," Rupp said. "Even the couple rounds that I played at the beginning of the year, I've noticed quite a bit of distance that I've gained. It's encouraging to see." A fact that could be discouraging to her competition, which already struggled to outplay her. Rupp won the Class 4A state title last season and enters her junior campaign as a championship contender for the spring. "I just want to do my best every tournament," Rupp said. "I know my game, and I know I can play well. I just want to go out and prove that I can compete." Rupp has been one of the top high school golfers from the time she started with the Lions. Her savvy play and short game helped counter opponents' edge and distance off the tee, is something she noticed during summer tournaments when she had to hit longer clubs than other players on approach shots and when she failed to reach some long par 4 holes in regulation. Rupp always is in search of being her best. "She's just a kid that wants to get better," Linmar coach Chris James said. "It's awesome. She's definitely her harshest critic. She is a kid that if she doesn't putt well in a meet and decides after the meet, while we're driving home, to go back to Hunter's Ridge and putt." James noted Rupp was 20 to 30 yards behind longer hitters, and they had conversations about making improvements. He has enjoyed hearing about her gains. "She was always up on her fitness, but it wasn't like to get bigger, stronger, hit the ball farther, or club head speed," James said. "She has always been a super scrambler and mentally tough, handling those situations better than most people. Now she'll be able to hit farther, hopefully. I think that will make more birdie opportunities for her." During the winter, Rupp had clubs in her hands a couple times a week, hitting in the cage in the family's garage. She has mirrors to see her swing and a monitor to track distance and statistics. Rupp also has a mat to work on, putting up to 6 feet. She devoted 5 days a week to weight training. "I have everything there, which I'm really grateful for," Rupp said. "Most of the time, too, my parents get up. They do some of their own workouts. We're down there at the same time. It helps to be able to work out with somebody else. The goal is to play in college." Rupp also realized she needed to gain distance to handle the longer courses she would see at the next level. "The work I have put in this winter has bridged that gap a little," she said. "I feel like it's been a lot more manageable." Rupp isn't content with last year's achievements either. The approach is to contend for a state title this season instead of defend her title. "Just play like there are no expectations," Rupp said. "I feel like I just want to go out and prove myself again. I did accomplish some great things last year, but I want to prove that I can do it again, and it wasn't a fluke that I deserve to accomplish all those things." In sports of area interest today, on the schedule, in high school track, Marion and Regina are at Mount Vernon's Invitational at 4 p.m. In girls soccer, Jefferson is at Marion at 5 p.m., Waterloo West is at Liberty at 5:15. In boys tennis, Grinnell is at Marion at 4 p.m. In girls tennis, Marion, Grinnell, and Maquoketa are at Mount Vernon, and that is at 9 a.m. Back to girls golf, here are some golfers to watch in this 2024 season. Morgan Rupp, again from Linmar, a junior, a 2023 Class 4A state champion, tied for fifth at state as a freshman. From Cedar Rapids, Washington, a junior, Jane Peterson, a 2023 4A state runner-up, placed 12th at state as a freshman, is first-team All-MVC Valley, and ranked 7th in all classes. Maya Messenger from Cedar Rapids, Washington, a senior, placed 19th at 4A in state last season, a first-team All-MVC Valley, Iowa MVC Super Meet medalist. From Western Dubuque's a senior, McKenna Stackus, a three-time state qualifier, placed 12th at the 2023 4A state tournament and tied for fifth at the 2022 state meet. From Lisbon, Kaylee Kelkin, a senior, placed 4th at 3A last year and finished 10th and 12th as a freshman and sophomore. From Cedar Rapids Xavier, two ladies, Mira Joka, a senior, three-time state qualifier, and Mihar Joka, a sophomore, tied for 10th at 3A last year. From Tipton, Pacey Sorgenfrey, a sophomore, tied for 3rd in 2A last year, is a River Valley Conference championship medalist. Isabella Peterson, a senior from Iowa City Liberty, placed 3rd in 2021 and 2022. From West Branch, a senior, Claire Jarrett, two-time state meet participant, placed 10th at 1A in the state tournament in 2023 and 9th in 2022. Turning to the hoopla section, this story by Elijah Desius. Restaurateur Duo opens a new pair of Mexican restaurants. A duo of experienced restaurateurs are trying their hand at a new pair of Cedar Rapids Mexican restaurants, filling the brief vacancies left in the New Bohemia District and in Northeast Cedar Rapids. Mestizo opened earlier this month, and Café Tagupa opened in December, and they offer an array of Mexican options in a saturated market. With modern street food fusions at Mextizo, that's M-E-X-T-I-Z-O, and a more abbreviated menu specializing in breakfast at the Café, that's C-A, capital F-E, Tacuba, the pair bring a taste of home with hands in the kitchen from Mexico City and Guadalajara. In brief, if you go, Mextizo, located at 1140 Blairs Ferry Road Northeast in Cedar Rapids, is open from 11 a.m. to 10 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 11 a.m. to 11 p.m. Friday and Saturday, 11 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sunday. They have a large menu that delivers a fusion of modern and Mexican street food influenced by Mexico City and Guadalajara. And Café Tacuba, which is located at 1006 3rd Street Southeast in Cedar Rapids, is open from 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. Monday through Thursday, 7 a.m. to 11 p.m. Friday and Saturday, and 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. on Sundays. Their tailored menu consists of Mexican dishes offered alongside a strong breakfast menu, both Mexican and American favorites, handcrafted coffee beverages, and a limited selection of cocktails and mimosas. Also in the food category, a new spicy chicken chain is planning its first Iowa restaurants. Following the rapid expansion of Raising Cane's, a new chicken restaurant is turning attention to Iowa as one of its last remaining frontiers of expansion. Dave's Hot Chicken, a fast casual concept known for its spicy Nashville-style chicken, has announced plans to build 5 locations in Iowa. The new franchisee agreements to enter the Iowa market includes 1 site each in Cedar Rapids, Coralville, and Davenport, plus 2 in the Des Moines metro area. With a presence in Chicago, Omaha, and Minneapolis, Dave's Hot Chicken has been eyeing Iowa since at least last year, when it announced its search for franchisees to bring the restaurants to the Hawkeye State. We filled almost every major market in the U.S. One of the few pockets we have available is Iowa, Shannon Swenson, vice president of development, previously told the Gazette. We're starting to fill in all around. Since the brand started franchising in 2019, it has expanded to more than 140 locations in the United States and Canada, and has more than 850 franchise commitments in the works. The timeline for Iowa openings has not been announced, but Swenson noted that openings across all target Iowa markets could take 3 to 5 years. The California-based restaurant first started as a parking lot pop-up in Los Angeles in 2017, where it quickly gained popularity among bloggers and food publication Eater Los Angeles. It's an amazing flavor profile. We have a cult-like following to the brand, Swanson said. 3 Eastern Iowa restaurants have made the top 10 list of finalists competing for the title of Iowa's Best Burger, the 15th annual competition hosted by the Iowa Beef Industry Council and Iowa Cattlemen's Association has given nods to restaurants in Waterloo, Monticello, and Iowa City, after tallying more than 7,500 ballots, voting on more than 500 nominees. The Eastern Iowa finalists are Big Head Burger in Waterloo, The Market at the Tap in Monticello, and Wilder at the Graduate Hotel in Iowa City. Other finalists around Iowa include Chuckwagon Restaurant in Adair, Flight Bar and Grill in Huxley, Houston's on Main in Milo, JJ's Tavern and Grill in Ankeny, Lucille's at the Continental Hotel in Centerville, and the Flying Elbow in Marshalltown and Williamson Tavern in Williamson. This year's top 10 restaurants are award-worthy, but are only a few of the many restaurants in Iowa that do an outstanding job of promoting and serving our beef products to their consumers on behalf of Iowa's beef farmers, said Kyle Peterson, Director of Marketing of the Iowa Beef Industry Council. All finalists will be visited by an anonymous panel of judges who will evaluate burgers on taste, appearance, and proper doneness of 160 degrees. Qualifying burgers must be 100% beef and served on a bun or bread product. The winner will be announced May 1 to kick off May Beef Month. Three of the top 10 restaurants in Adair, Marshalltown, and Huxley are past winners. Lucille's at the Continental Hotel was previously a top 10 finalist. An Eastern Iowa restaurant has not held the title since the Cider House of Fairfield won in 2015. And Big Grove Brewery has announced the nonprofit recipients of $48,000 in 2024 grants for Linn, Johnson, and Polk counties. This year's Linn County recipients are Young Parents Network, which offers parenting classes for first-time parents, and Eastern Iowa Arts Academy, which makes arts accessible to K-12 students through programming in public schools and a local campus of music and art studios. This year is Big Grove for Good's first time offering grants in Linn County following the brewery's December taproom opening in Cedar Rapids. Johnson County recipients are the Antelope Lending Library, an independent bookmobile dedicated to providing equal access to information, and Wright House of Fashion, which offers youth engaging opportunities to gain experience in fashion and apparel design. Each recipient, selected from a pool of almost 200 applications, received $8,000. "We were overwhelmed with the response and interest in our grant program this year," said Michaela Demet, Big Grove's community and project manager. "Our grant committees in each location spent hours reviewing each application and discussing who we could best partner with and support the work they do in their communities." Ending up briefly with the weather, looking for mostly sunny skies today, mostly cloudy tomorrow, and partly cloudy again on Saturday. Normal high for today is 53, and we're looking to reach that and more. The normal low is 31. A record high today is 81. That was set in 1968. The record low of 9 degrees was set in 1970. Sunset tonight is at 7:28 p.m., sunrise tomorrow at 6:54 a.m., giving us 12 hours and 33 minutes of daylight, and we are in that full moon phase with moon rise at 11:15 and set at 8:42. And that does it for the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for today on IRIS. I've been your reader, Kathleen. You can access today's reading online at iowaradioreading.org. Thank you for listening, and have a great, safe day. Thank you.
From the Bureau of Economic Geology, this is Earth Date. Sometimes we have too much electricity, but more often, grid operators are carefully managing its production to be sure that we have enough. So, a lot of work has gone into trying to store excess electricity to use later when we need it. The obvious solution, giant batteries, is still too expensive for most applications and has environmental implications. This has led scientists to look for other ways. One method uses surplus power to compress air and pump it into old salt mines. The salt tends to seal cracks in the walls, making the mines airtight. When needed, the compressed air can be released to turn a turbine, or it can be used as the intake air for a natural gas power plant, making the plant more productive. Another way to store excess energy is to pump water uphill into existing reservoirs and then release it through hydroelectric dams when power is needed. This method was pioneered 100 years ago in Italy and Switzerland and is used today around the world and in many U.S. states, like Michigan. On the Chilean coast, they're even experimenting with using solar energy to pump seawater up a cliff where it could flow down to make power at night. These solutions don't make economic sense unless the electricity is very cheap and the reservoir was already built for another purpose. But when those two things are present, pumping air and water to store energy plays a valuable role in balancing the grid to meet our ever-changing power demands. For Earth Date, I'm Scott Tinker.
Earth Date is produced by the Bureau of Economic Geology at the University of Texas at Austin, with support from Schlumberger, helping oil and gas companies increase production and efficiency while lowering environmental impact. You can hear more Earth Date stories at earthdate.org.